Glenn, Dr. Lang, and friends, I must begin with an apology. I'm not going to speak on the subject announced. I didn't speak on the announced subject this morning. Mr. Binkley was very kind and didn't announce it. When I was in my salad days as a preacher a long, long time ago now, I projected a series of sermons, announced sermon subjects, far ahead of the preparation of the sermons. A text in the book of Proverbs, I think it's in Proverbs, maybe it's in Ecclesiastes, had captured my eye, and this looked like a good, live topic to put on a card. Might attract people to come. So the subject was announced was Living Dogs and Dead Lions. Friday came along. I had been thinking about that sermon all week, and I looked at the text, and I looked at it upside down. Nothing came. And Saturday. And all it said was that living dogs are better than dead lions, and somebody said it isn't true, and true or false. What more could you say about it? Living dogs, dead lions. I cried to the Lord in my distress. And I got a telegram from my brother saying he's coming to town. And I met him at the station early Sunday morning and said, you've got to preach for me. Now I announced these subjects not before I made my preparation, but in the midst of my preparation. And the material was working out something like this. The Christian, the Protestant sources of democratic life, the democratic sources of religious life, here we are working together. We are Americans, we are Christian, and we're Protestant Christian. Here is the way it works out. We must define ourselves. But when I tried to work this material into lecture form finally, getting away from my various notes, it wouldn't yield to that pattern. And so this morning I spoke to you about Protestantism as a dynamic movement of protest and of revival. Not a single protest, but a series of protests. Not a single revival, but a series of revivals. And tonight, I would like to have you take a look at me. Look with me. Unfortunately, the other thing is good. Take a look with me at the way in which Protestantism defines itself and is defined. Not in a situation of protest against some form of faith and order, but as it defines itself and is defined in its relationship to a political and a cultural order. We define ourselves as Protestants, particularly in America, not only through self-knowledge, but through resolution and through action. In this symbiosis, in this living together with a world. Church and world, these are forever together and have been together at all times, and doubtless always will be. This seems to be the ordination of the Lord. Church in the world, church for the world, church against the world, but always church and world. And church is what it is. Protestant church is what it is, not only on account of the deposit in it and the movement in it that arises out of the internal revivals, and not only on account of the protests which it makes against other forms of ecclesiastical life, but by the way it cooperates with, then stands against, and associates with the world around it. Well, the growth for us in America, but not only in America, has been for Protestantism a democratic world. There seems to be a certain relationship between Protestantism and democracy, which it is a little difficult to figure out. But the Protestantism of Geneva was associated with a movement that was a somewhat democratic movement, though those who have a very particular definition of democracy will refuse that name to Geneva. The Protestantism of the Netherlands was associated with a national movement that also had certain features which we might call the features of democracy in a broad sense. The Protestantism of England, of the Puritan movement associated with Cromwellianism, had an association with something like democracy. Today, when you look at the Protestant world and at the democratic world, to a very large extent, you find a certain correlation. The democratic countries and the Protestant countries, in general, fall into the same class. There's Germany, the old home of Protestantism. We might raise a question about it. It has been monarchic, it has been democratic, it has had this strange history through the 19th century with its abortive revolutions, and in the 20th century with its short-lived democracies, and then its dictatorships and its monarchies. But here is a country now ruled by a Catholic party, never been wholly Protestant. And here is France, a democratic country. That doesn't quite fit in, does it? Democratic and Catholic, and yet with a Catholicism that has a very large element of liberalism in it, or a very large element of anti-clericalism in it. Now, there are exceptions, but by and large, the Scandinavian countries, the Netherlands, Switzerland, Great Britain, the United States, the Protestant countries, the democratic countries, fall into the same general class. And so sometimes we try to argue it one way or the other and say, historically, Protestantism is the cause of democracy. Or the other way around, democracy is the cause of Protestantism. Just as we do with capitalism and Protestantism. Many books are written on this subject. I counsel you sometime to go to a library and to look up the books on democracy. If you think there is a lot of sameness in what is written on apologetics in Christianity, and there is a terrible amount of sameness, theological students have not yet discovered it. But by the time you get 60, if you keep on reading, you will find that you've read most of the stuff. It's repeated over and over and over again. Now, if this is true in the case of apologetics, it is certainly also true in the case of the apologetics of democracy and of all the things that are written under such subjects as the faith of our fathers, about the American Constitution, and about the great liberties which we enjoy as Americans. Now, one may try to say this democracy, and this has been said in their books on the subject, has its solid roots in Calvinism. And then someone comes along and disproves. After all, Calvinism was not democratic. But then there's another book written, or an article, a recent article I discovered by Dr. Talvis, which says, of course, this democracy was not based in the Reformation of the continent and in Calvin primarily. It was based on, something partly continental, on the left-wing Reformation, on the ideas of the Anabaptists and then of certain mystics. It was left-wing Reformationism that produced this democracy. But then alongside of that, there is another book which seems to make the Quakers the authors of our democracy. Now, certainly they had a lot to do with this left-wing Protestantism, and still they are folk of a different sort. And the Methodists can make certain claims this democracy was founded, as certain books on the 18th century revival indicate, in the great evangelical and Methodist movement, etc., etc. It doesn't quite work out like that, does it? One suspects that some of these arguments are highly defensive arguments, and that they have issued out of a Protestantism that has already become over-democratic. That is, out of a Protestantism that has accepted as its real religion the religion of democracy, and which tries to justify this Christian faith as useful to democracy. As though this were something favorable to be said about us. As in other days, the church was praised because it was a support for our monarchy, or a support for aristocracy, or something of that sort. Now that is not the relationship for which we are looking. It happens, doesn't it? It happens that one of these parts, church and world, Protestantism or democracy, becomes dominant, and that the other one then becomes a kind of pale reflection of the first. Professor Mead, who has written several articles in preparation for the book he's doing on American Protestantism, writes about our post-Civil War period in America like this: what was not so obvious at the time was that the United States, in effect, had two religions, or at least two different forms of the same religion, and that the prevailing Protestant ideology represented a syncretistic mingling of the two. The first was the religion of the denominations, which was commonly articulated in terms of scholastic Protestant orthodoxy, and almost universally practiced in terms of the experimental religion of pietistic revivalism. This defines for our purposes Protestant evangelicalism. The second was the religion of the democratic society and nation. This was rooted in the rationalism of the Enlightenment, to go no further back, and was articulated in terms of the destiny of America under God, to be fulfilled by perfecting the democratic way of life for the example and betterment of all mankind. This was a calling taken as seriously as every Christian saint or administrator took his peculiar vocation. Said one of its high priests in 1826, "We stand the latest, and if we fail, probably the last experiment of self-government by the people." This religion was almost universally practiced in terms of the burgeoning middle-class society and its free enterprise system, the most persuasive argument for which was the plain fact that it worked to the economic and general material betterment of men, until Andrew Carnegie, in summarizing his version of its beneficent effects, could say that such is the true gospel concerning wealth, obedience to which is destined someday to solve the problem of the rich and the poor, and to bring peace on earth among men of goodwill. We can find many statements of this sort, of course, about the religion of democracy. And you can find many indications that there was a time in Protestant history in America, a time which has not wholly passed in some sectors, when this religion practiced in the Protestant churches was as much a celebration of the national faith, of the religion of democracy, as any worship in a Shinto shrine was the worship of Japanese way, of the Japanese way of life. Oh, we know this story from history, do we not? Man's other religion, as it was described some years ago in a book, is always nationalism. That's always his other religion. And it is closely related to our faith. And one can't easily succumb to the other. But on the whole, the relations between democracy and Protestantism have been far more complex than that. And will continue to be more complex than that. They are more complex, for one thing, because Protestantism, as we tried to understand this morning, is a vital movement that appears in many different forms. For another thing, because this democracy of ours is a movement of similar vitality, which has no single form, but has appeared in Western history and then in American history in various forms, continuous with each other without a doubt, but not easily representable as variants on one orthodox theme. One thinks of that first form of democracy, which you might call English democracy, that appeared in Virginia and in New England, when the Puritans and the Anglicans came to the shore, maintaining the rights of Englishmen and following by and large in their thinking, as expressed also in their religious sermons when they were political, the philosophy of John Locke. Here was the philosopher of democracy. Let's call it English democracy. It was a democracy of the common law, which said we will be ruled by laws and not by men. Laws are always over men. The king must be subject to the law. And we, as Englishmen, claim the rights that have been granted to us, which we have wrested, as it were, from the sovereign in Magna Carta and in many another enactment. But then there was a second variety of democracy, a second form of democracy which appeared in America. It was also in part an importation, though it was domesticated here and became a vital movement in our midst. We generally call it Jeffersonian democracy rather than Puritan democracy or the English democracy or colonial democracy. Its philosopher was Rousseau. The rights which it proclaimed were not the rights of Englishmen, but the rights of man. The will with which it was concerned was not the will of the sovereign nation, but the general will that expressed itself in the great unity of a nation or of mankind, kind of a mystic conception of a general will. And that Jeffersonian democracy had its literary and certainly also its political consequences and expressions. But then we had in America, and none of the things that we had are really gone, they're still here in one form or another. Then we had what we call our Jacksonian democracy. Let's call it national democracy. This celebrated, it seems to me, the rights of the American. This was the movement of liberation, not from foreign domination by foreign political institutions, but liberation from domination by old world institutions, old world habits. It was the democracy of the common man, the democracy of the frontier, as the Turner School frequently calls it. It was a democracy that celebrated the American destiny. It was national democracy. It came to expression in the kind of statement which Professor Mead quotes here, This is the nation in which the great experiment of self-government is being tried, and perhaps for the last time. We are the last best hope of earth, national democracy. It was the kind of democracy that attracted so many immigrants then who came to these shores and who wanted to leave behind old world pressures of one kind and another, for whom the new world was a liberation from military service, from the domination of landlords and one thing and the other, particularly from the poverty of the old world. That was a form of democracy which we find celebrated in the literature of the time, and it is still with us. Then what about the kind of philosophy of democracy which began to flourish after our great war, and partly perhaps in the very midst of it? The democracy of which Emerson was the prophet, in the way in which Locke and Rousseau had been the prophets or the philosophers of another kind, of an earlier form of democracy. Individualistic democracy, free enterprise democracy. The democracy which didn't stress the rights of the common man or the rights of man, but which stressed the liberty of the individual to be left alone and to go ahead with his own concerns and his own interests. It was concerned with the right to be left alone, which one of our Supreme Court justices has recently spoken of as one of the great rights of man. It wasn't concerned a great deal with the right to worship God in our own way. That right to worship God in our own way had been very important for people who had wanted to worship God in accordance with their duty. It wasn't so awfully important anymore for people who said religious freedom means going to church whether if you please, not going to church if you don't please. It's the liberty to be irreligious. It's the liberty of those who say religion's not a very important matter. For folks for whom the democracy of the rights of man was important, really important, the right to religious freedom was the right to carry out a duty. But for these free enterprise, these individualistic democrats, well, this wasn't really so important anymore, was it? It wasn't so terribly important that one should have the right to free speech because one had to speak the truth as one saw it. But it had become very important that one should be able to utter one's opinions if there was a sale for them. Say anything, was it? Truth to lies, this is all free speech. Let's have freedom in the press. Not because we must be able to speak the truth, whether or not the government allows us speaking of the truth, but because we ought to have the right to sell our novels, tell our stories, paint our pictures, as we please, not in accordance with ultimate duties laid on us by conscience, but as we please. I am doubtless making something of a caricature of this individualistic democracy, but the emphasis it does seem to me in a certain period of our history, and now in a certain segment of our culture, lies upon individualistic freedom, rather than upon the exercise of rights that are laid on man with duties that are imposed upon. We've had another form of democracy, social democracy. We have been involved in the movement of social democracy through much of this 20th century. It has been in conflict at certain points with individualistic democracy. It has been the democracy which has stressed the people's welfare, which has stressed the rights of groups to assert themselves, which has stressed a liberation from domination by certain non-political forces in the society. The kind of a democracy of which not a Jackson or a Jefferson, but of which the first and perhaps and doubtless the second Roosevelt were the prophets. Each one of these democratic movements has been concerned with a liberation from something, not always with a liberation from the same. Each one of these movements has been concerned with the exercise of an initiative, but not always with the exercise of the initiative upon the part of the same groups. There have been varieties in these forms of democracy, and it is not easy to reduce them to one common denominator, to say we all know what democracy is. Democracy is government of the people, for the people, by the people. If this were true, what would happen to the rights of minorities or to the rights of man? This democracy has been a multifarious thing, and our Protestantism has lived with this multifarious democracy. And it has in part influenced this democracy, and it has been influenced by it in turn. Let us look at some of the kinships between forms of Protestantism and forms of democracy. It will be too much to claim that the kinship is due to historical causality, but let us just speak of kinship now. Here's Calvinistic and Puritan Protestant. The kind of Protestantism which flourished in New England and then in other parts of the nation. It came to our shores. It existed in a kind of unity with, association with a democracy, as I pointed out, with the democracy of the English common law. But then it set forth certain great religious themes, certain great Christian themes that seemed to be important for the conduct of government and for the formation of the associations of people into culture. Its fundamental principle was the transcendence of the sovereign God. We are ruled in our existence by the one who is the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings. It is not for us to say that we are our own. We are not our own. We are God's. It is not up to us to decide what we shall do. He is the decider and he is the elector. He elects to happiness and to damnation, to holiness and to sin, as it were. But we are in the hands of one who is sovereign power and who is sovereign will, the lawgiver. He is our lawgiver. And to him, beyond all churches and all kingdoms, we are responsible. On him we are dependent. And this relationship is immediate. Now this idea is reflected, isn't it, in a certain kind of democracy, as we shall have to note a little bit more, whenever the ideas that we find on the religious side, on the Protestant side, are expressed on the democratic side, on the political side, or on the cultural side, they appear in a paler form. But something like this idea did appear in the form of deism. Nature and nature's God have made us thus and thus. We are by nature related to and ultimate, not call it a kingdom now, but to a kind of an ultimate society in which we have the rights and the duties of men. This Puritan Protestantism had the conception, the conviction that we lived in a reign of law. The will of God was one will. This will of God was doubtless expressed in many different forms. Its primary form was this scriptural form of the revealed law of God. But it was also recognizable, as the medieval Catholics had said, and as these Protestants now agreed, in its rational form, in its natural law form, and it had a relationship to the common law of the land. Natural law, revealed law, civil law, these were forms of one law. To it, man was subject. To be sure, this law had different uses. The law, for one thing, was given to man in order to lead him to repentance, to convict him of sin. And it was only in the church that this conviction of sin could be achieved. It was when the law was preached in the context of the gospel that conviction of sin, repentance, took place. The law had another use. It had the use of counsel. When a man was repentant and had been brought to faith, then he read the law again as counsel. Then the thou shalt not kill was not his condemnation as a murderer. But then it was the counsel to him to protect and care for his neighbor. Then it appeared in its Sermon on the Mount form, rather than in its Ten Commandment form. And so with all the other commandments. Thou shalt not steal. This became, when it returned from repentance and conviction of sin to counsel, the commandment to give your cloak to the neighbor and not to turn away from the one who wanted to borrow from you. But it was always one law. However, in addition to these two uses of the law, the use in condemnation and conviction of sin, and the use in counsel, there was a third use of the law. It needed to be used to restrain us from overt wickedness. And this was the function of the state. It was only the state that could really use this law in the way of restraint and say, thou shalt not kill, not so as to convict of sin, for this could not be done by a state, but so that the killer was restrained from killing again, and that others were restrained from killing, from overt killing, though they might have murder in their hearts, by seeing the example of the one who was being restrained. Church and state, under the law, needed to be separate. Under one law, under one dominion. But the law has different uses. One sovereign, God, sovereign of the church, sovereign of the state, but not in such a way that he was sovereign of the state through the church, or sovereign of the church through the state, but in such a way that the magistrate on the one hand and the eldership and the preachers on the other were directly responsible to the one sovereign God and had before them the one constitution, the law, in its manifold forms. Sometimes our historians, writing about conceptions of democracy that are of a later time, speak of this Calvinistic notion as theocratic, which it indeed was, God the ruler. But then they mean by theocracy, hierocracy, the rulership of priests, and that it was not. For all you have to do is read how Calvin contended for the independence of the church from the state, in Geneva, fought for the separation of church and state, though their separateness was to be the separateness of those who functioned under one Lord, doing different tasks.
Now, when the state takes a hold, or when on the democratic side you see these ideas of law, and these ideas of separation of the powers of church and state develop, doubtless they take a different form from the form which they take within the church, but they are there. Or take another illustration of an idea in that Puritan or Calvinistic Protestantism which had its effects, or which had its affiliations with democratic ideas. The idea of compact. Professor Perry Miller of Harvard has recently put all theologians in his debt by his magnificent historical researches into New England theology, and by unearthing for us historically the meaningfulness of the covenant theology of that Puritanism. Life was covenant. To be sure, the Lord was king, but the Lord's kingship was not exercised by decree and ukase. It was exercised in covenant relationships. He was the God of promise and the one who expected promise. We're just beginning, perhaps, in Protestantism to see again the tremendous significance of the covenant idea about ourselves, that the most important thing you can say about a man is not that he's a rational animal, define him in some other fashion, but that you can say he's the covenanting animal, or the covenanting being. He's the man who lives by promise, by making promises, by accepting covenants, by swearing to his own hurt and changing not, perhaps, by entering into agreements in which he binds himself unlimitedly, by making marriage a covenant, by making his association with others in political society a covenant, by making his relations in church a covenant. A covenant that is always a covenant with his fellow men and a covenant with his God. And where he stands, the fundamental relationship which I have with the ultimate reality, the power of God, is the relationship of one who has come into covenant, to whom God has made a promise, to whom almighty power has given its word. Well, that covenant idea is a great idea. The Puritans had it. And they said, because they were using this covenant idea for the understanding of the whole of human existence, that all their affairs had to be regulated by covenant, not because this was something externally imposed on them by the scriptures, but because it was the very law of life, the law of God. This is the way life is constituted. Now you look at democratic society alongside of that, and you notice how many of the democratic governments are founded on the basis of covenant. We the people, we agree together, we promise each other, we enter into this engagement. The democracy, the kind of democracy which was associated with that covenant theology of Puritanism, was democracy which emphasized the covenantal relationships present in all of our political arrangements. Our laws are promises. We have promised these things to each other. Life, including political life, is based on promise. It may be that a nation can begin in mere togetherness. But that's not yet to be a nation. It may be that it can continue because folk want to pursue certain common interests. But that becomes a kind of a contract society where we say, as long as you serve my interests, I'll serve your interests, and if you betray me, then I'll give up. No, a nation comes into being and exists as a nation only when you enter into covenant and say, in sickness and in health, in prosperity and in adversity, if you betray me or if you don't betray me, I will be loyal. Isn't this family community? Togetherness? Yes, that belongs to it. Falling in love? That belongs to it. Having common interests? That belongs to it. But where will man and wife achieve the nobility of mature human beings if they do not enter into the covenant? I say, I promise. It's not an affair of my feelings. It's not a business of my interests. I enter into this as a promising man. Well, that was democratic society in a way, wasn't it? A certain kind of democracy. A government is an affair of covenant among all the people who keep laws, not because they're given to them from above, but because they're all parties to the covenant, because they've all made the promise and they're all protectors of the law. There are, of course, relations of democratic society to other forms of Protestantism. In connection with this first Puritan form, I think I should say one other thing, and that is that its belief in the corruptness of man had a counterpart in what happened in democratic society. The Puritan Protestant believe that the imaginations of the human heart are corrupt from use. There was none good, no, not one. But they had all fallen short and would all fall short of the glory of God. This meant something to him in church government. It meant you better associate with the teacher and the pastor, some elders. Don't trust the preacher too far. Don't trust the elders too far. Get a balanced government here. See that people check each other. But don't trust the people too far. They need this preacher. They need these elders. They need this kind of government. The voice of the people is not the voice of God either. Now, what about saying our American democracy has a large element of this belief in the corruptness of man in it? It's written into its very constitution, in a sense. Lord Bryce, who's written a very one of the classic statements about American democracy, though it was done many years ago, says this: someone has said that the American government and constitution are based on the theology of Calvin and the philosophy of Hobbes. This at least is true, that there is a hearty Puritanism in the view of human nature which pervades the instrument of 1787. It is the work of men who believed in original sin and were resolved to leave open for transgressors no door which they could possibly shut. Compare this spirit with the enthusiastic optimism of the Frenchman of 1789. It is not merely a difference of race temperaments, it is a difference of fundamental ideas. The aim of the Constitution seems to be not so much to attain great common ends by securing a good government as to avert the evils which will flow not merely from a bad government, but from any government strong enough to threaten the pre-existing communities or the individual citizens. One element in this American democracy then was sense. Every group and every individual is subject to corruption and is corrupt. Trust none too far. Give power to the majority, but for goodness sakes, protect the rights of the minority, for the majority will abuse the minority if it gets the chance. Trust the wisest in the nation. Have an elective aristocracy, not a birthright aristocracy. Elective, but balance that power with the election of the representatives of the common men. Have a strong executive, but not too strong. Balance it with judicial power. Balance the judicial power with the legislative power. Balance the rights of the central government, the federal government, by the rights of the states. Balance the rights of the states with the rights of the local communities. Everywhere, see to it that since power is used corruptly, not too much power will be employed. You get the philosophy in its secular form in James Madison in many a statement of his. Does the Protestant theory here cause the democratic theory? Or is there a certain kinship here? Doubtlessly, Democrats in the secular realm received these ideas from other sources than from the Puritans or from John Calvin. They got them directly from Montesquieu and from others. But there was a kinship here. There are the democratic ideas which arose out of or which were associated with the ideas of the religious convictions of the left-wing Reformation. Here, instead of thinking of the immanent, of the transcendence of God, the sovereign Lord with his law, you thought of the immanent spirit, of God ruling, of God working through the hearts, of God the Spirit dwelling within. Now for that left-wing Protestantism, the Spirit of God manifested itself in extraordinary outpourings, manifested itself in extraordinary changes of the conscience. It was not a Spirit of God that was reserved to the ordained proclaimers. It could appear in the common man. In its quicker form, this light within, this might dawn in the soul of a fox far more readily than in the soul of some educated Oxford man. God was no respecter of persons. But here was something imminent that was to be trusted. On the democratic side, this kind of a doctrine became secularized. There is something in man, in every man, in the ordinary man, which is trustworthy, which speaks the voice of God. The voice of the people is the voice of God. There were other ideas, of course, connected with that left-wing Reformation. Among them, an idea of the separateness of the spiritual life and of the life in temporal and material society. I remember how astonished I was in reading the writings of Roger Williams to discover that Roger Williams, this very astute political worker and organizer, had another side to his existence so deeply spiritual that most of the commentators on Williams' work had completely passed it by. Nobody was writing or even making any references to his spiritual exercise in spiritual life and health. All were talking about the bloody talent of persecution. And it became apparent to me, reading his letters, reading this marvelous book about the spiritual life, that for Roger Williams there was a deep cleft between the spiritual world and this temporal world. Here was a separateness of the spiritual life and of the temporal life
that was rather different from the separateness of Calvinistic and Puritan thinking. When it was translated in a secular fashion, it came to mean something rather different from what it meant to Roger Williams. Then it meant this religion, this spiritual life, that's a private matter. Not this is the thing that a man in his loneliness must fight out with his God, but this is a private matter. It's of no concern to us, really, in our political life. Separation of church and state now means separation of all of our ordinary existence from a special religious existence. And so one might go on. Speak of the democratic consequences or of the democratic accompaniments of the Protestantism of the Great Awakening, of how in that Great Awakening the right of the common man to become sanctified through conversion, to become a member of the church, an elector in the church, was manifested. Again, Perry Miller has interpreted that Great Awakening in these terms and said this had its counterpart in a democratic society where now everybody was entitled to the franchise, not because he had been internally reconstructed, but because he was a man. Doubtless it had to be done like that. But there was a counterpart between the democracy in the church of the Great Awakening and the democracy of the common man in the society. There was the humanism, no, the humanitarianism of the Great Awakening. What does this mean now? That we are converted. It means that the great test is not the godly, sober, and righteous life of the Puritan, but it means the life of the humanitarian, of the one who seeks to rid men of their diseases, to save the lost, to bind up the broken wounds, broken-hearted, and bind up the wounds of man. Humanitarianism, and this was associated with humanism on the democratic side. Protestantism in its various forms, democracy in its various forms, go side by side. But the form in which these ideas appear on the democratic side are always secular. And it is necessary that they should be so. There isn't in them the requirement for regeneration, for instance, which is present on the religious and the Protestant side. But then a strange thing happens, that the secular form in which these human ideas appear, the political form, if we may call it that, in which these great ideas appear, reacts on the religious side, and after a while the glorious light within becomes the ordinary human conscience. And after a while the principle that before God there is no respect of persons becomes the principle in the church itself of an equality that was pronounced in the political sphere. After a while the principle that God is our Lord and requires of us our duty becomes on the political side, having become on the political side, the principle of religious indifference becomes on the Protestant side the principle of, well, after all, religion is a private matter. Protestantism can succumb to its friendly neighbor, democracy, no less than that it can make its contributions to that neighbor. We can make no contributions to our companion if this is our main intention. If we think of ourselves as the servants of democracy, but we will make and do make a contribution, it seems, and have made in history, when we have said we stand first of all in another service. Democracy or no democracy, we have our job to do as Protestants. We have a service to render which is not the service of the people. We have a voice to hear which is not the voice of the people. We have a word to proclaim which is not the word of the people.
But when we do these things, then our companion, this world, doubtless will profit by our service.